This is the Financial Sense News Hour. With the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to Lifetime Income on the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, even though this segment, usually we talk about planning for retirement and retirement planning with the baby boomers heading into retirement, probably the largest retirement generation in the country's history. But we're going to give you some tips on to-dos depending on how far away you might be for retirement. In other words, not just talking about retirement, but what if you're 10 years away from retiring, 5 years away from retiring? What should you be doing to plan for that event? There are a number of steps we're going to cover in today's program.
Well, Jim, I think one of the things that most people look forward to in retirement is travel. We're pretty lucky today because we're going to have Christopher Elliott of Nat Geo's Traveler magazine on today. He's going to be talking about traveling and travel costs. So Chris Elliott and his travel tips will be coming up later on in the program. But for right now, Jim, let's go back to talking about the different stages of planning for retirement. So let's talk about what happens if you're not quite 10 years away from retirement.
Well, when we think about retirement planning, you think, okay, I just got the notice from the company, I'm eligible, or I just turned 65 or 66. The problem, Kathleen, with retirement planning isn't a one-shot process. Your retirement plan basically has phases: pre-retirement, retirement, and then the different phases throughout your retirement lifetime. Because as we talked about, statistically, a husband and wife can plan on spending between 20 to 25 years in their retirement. And obviously, at different phases, your needs need to be reviewed every year to make sure you're still on track. Whether you're 10 years away from retirement or even 20 years is the best way that you can set yourself up so that when you do arrive at that date, you've met your retirement goals.
Jim, I think as we're talking today, what some of our listeners might notice is that really at each phase of the process, whether you're 10 years or 5 years or 2 years away from retirement, the steps are pretty similar. But what really changes is the immediacy and the specificity of the steps you should be taking in that particular phase of your preparation for retirement.
Yeah, let's take somebody that's maybe 10 years away from retirement, Kathleen. Let's say they're 55, 56, you know, the kids are out of college, maybe a few of them are married at this point. So now you're really thinking, okay, you're an empty nester, or maybe you're close to becoming an empty nester, and you're thinking, what should I be doing now? If you're 10 years away from retirement, you may be using an overall financial plan in which, let's say, your retirement plan is only playing a supporting role. Maybe there were other goals prior to that: buying a home, saving for education, getting the kids through college, saving for those weddings or other special celebrations, bar mitzvahs, etc. So savings need to be allocated. In retirement, usually when a couple starts out or you're starting out life, retirement is sort of at the back of the list. But as you age and you get closer and closer, that needs to move to the forefront. So basically, as soon as you can start earning income, the day you get out of college, you start a job, you start a business, you really should implement a retirement savings plan of some kind. Even though during your initial years, let's say when you're first getting married, maybe buying a house, putting money for a college education may be top priority, but you should have something that you're putting in a retirement program. Maybe it's only as much as putting some money in a 401k plan. And especially if you're starting out early and you work for a company that is giving you matching contributions. You know, some companies, Kathleen, will match you dollar for dollar up to a certain amount. Some will match you 50%. But think about it this way. The first year you put that dollar in, if the company's matching you 100% or 50%, you've made 100% on your money or 50% rate of return on that money for that year. But anyway, you should focus on the plan. And especially when you get close to that 10-year mark, I think focusing on putting things in order becomes critical.
So, Jim, why don't we focus specifically on what if you're at that 10-year mark, you've been thinking about retirement, and like you said, maybe you're 55 and you always had in your mind you're going to retire at age 65. So here you are, you're 10 years away. People are going to love hearing this again, Jim, but this is the time again where you need to really sit down with your budget again. And there are some things that you might want to think about at this point in your planning situation. One of the first things you want to think about with your budget is there anything that's going to change when you retire? Let's say maybe you'll support a relative. Maybe it's a kid. Maybe it's a parent. Maybe that somehow came into your horizon in retirement that maybe wasn't there before. So that's something to think about. That might actually hit your plate. Have you and your spouse been talking about maybe making a move when you retire? Maybe your kids left the house. Maybe they've moved to a different state. Maybe they're across the country. You're missing your grandbabies. So maybe you're thinking about changing, either moving to a smaller home or a bigger home, moving to a different city or different state. All those things can impact your retirement budget pretty specifically. Jim, I think something else that tends to hit by this point in people's lives too is that those really significant health issues start to crop up. You know, you might experience some sort of heart problem or some kind of chronic illness like diabetes, for example. Some of these things start to manifest right about this age frame, you know, 55 to 60. So when you hit that 10 years out from retirement, you'll have a better idea of what type of illnesses tend to hit your family at this phase in their lives. We get a good feel for, you know, is dementia or Alzheimer's going to start to be a problem? Maybe you sort of notice that longevity is an issue as well. So you need to start factoring in long-term care more than you thought you were going to. So something else you want to think about too is, rather than get blindsided by all these medical expenses in retirement, start doing a little bit of background research into Medicare well before you retire. So you can kind of start figuring out what options or plans you might be directed towards and how much those things might cost for you. So Jim, really, again, the foundation for any plan or reviewing any plan is going to always start with, what's my spend rate? What's my budget?
The other thing I think you also have to think about, Kathleen, is revisit your investment strategy. Obviously, if you're 10 years away from retirement, you're going to want to start scaling back some of the risk. Are you behind or ahead of your retirement savings goals? And you may have to make some adjustments. In other words, if you thought you were going to have X amount of dollars when you retire, you can take a look at what you have now. Are you on track to meeting that goal? Are you falling short? And if you are falling short, you might want to think of increasing your saving or cutting back on expenses. And one of the things I see people do sometimes is, and we've seen this and we've talked about it on the program, is they all of a sudden go for broke. They say, oh, I'm not meeting my retirement goals. I've fallen short. I'm going to put all my assets in one area. And we've seen this over the last couple of years where if you put money in gold bullion from 2001 to 2012, gold bullion went up every year as gold went from 250 all the way up to 1900. But 1900 was September 2011. We're in the 1200 range today. Or they might have done something like put everything in bond funds. So are you behind or ahead of your retirement savings goal? And I think that the best way, if you've fallen behind, you might want to think of increasing saving, cutting expenses. Also, consider moving down the risk scale of your investments. I really strongly urge not to be taking big risk if you've fallen short of your goals. This isn't the time, if you're 10 years away, to start rolling the dice with your investment portfolio. So maybe if you're in the stock market, you want to reduce exposure to, let's say, high-risk companies. Maybe you start moving to low to moderate-risk companies like some of the large-cap blue-chip stocks we've talked on the weekend program that make up the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Think about also adding some exposure to bonds, even if interest rates make it sensible not to do so. You might think, well, the Fed's talking about raising interest rates. Kathleen, when I got in this business in 1979, 1980, we were doing laddered bonds because bonds had been rising throughout that decade. But most people that were retired, at least the ones that we were working with, we put together a laddered bond portfolio because we didn't know where interest rates were going to peak. And it turned out it worked out beautifully when the client always got their income needs. Their income never changed. And then, of course, when the principal came due, they always got their money back.
So, Jim, speaking of bonds, I know that you and John Loeffler had a conversation about this particular issue over the weekend, especially about interest rates and where they're at right now. Just in case some of our listeners out there haven't had a chance to hear that program yet, would you mind just summarizing some of the highlights from your conversation with John about bond interest rates?
Yeah, I think that one of the things we talked about is in the bond market cycles, both bull and bear markets tend to last, Kathleen, somewhere in the neighborhood between 26 to 32 years. This one's getting long in the tooth. It began in 1981 when interest rates peaked in August of that year. And even though we've had some blips along the way, interest rates have been coming down since that time. And they reached a low last summer, just slightly below 1.4%. Now, the day you and I are doing this program, interest rates are somewhere between 2.5 and 2.6%. So they've gone up over 1% over the last year. And so we have a graph that we show our clients. It's called Climbing the Mountain. And if you look at interest rates started to rise in the United States in the early 1950s, and they continued to rise from 1950 all the way, Kathleen, to 1981, representing a 30-year cycle. And you can look at the history of interest rates in the United States, and they've averaged this 30-rate cycle. Now, what has happened to most people that have invested in bonds? They probably invested in bond funds. It seemed like the sensible thing to do if you're retired. Well, if you did that and you retired at the beginning of the last decade, your principal was safe, but every single year you saw your income go down in your bond fund because as interest rates came down, the bond fund manager had to roll those bonds that matured into lower paying bonds, or they took in more money from new investors and they bought lower income bonds. So every single year, even though you were in bonds, you saw your income decline. Well, Kathleen, what happened this year in the first two quarters of the year? For the first time, bond investors have experienced actual losses. There were double-digit losses in the second quarter, and we are now going to begin that cycle of rising interest rates that will probably play out over the next 2 to 3 decades. And if you're in a rising interest rate cycle, you still want to have bonds in your portfolio. They provide stability, which you're going to want in retirement. You're not going to want to be retired and look at your portfolio go up and down 30 or 40%. You want to reduce volatility. And that's the role that bonds play in a portfolio, in addition to providing predictable income, but they also provide stability in a portfolio. We just favor a laddered bond portfolio because, number one, I know what the income's going to be, and number two, I know what the principal is going to be when the bonds mature.
Jim, when you start talking about interest rate cycles, I think what this means to me, Jim, when I think about talking to investors about retirement, is that as you start approaching, you know, this 10-year mark, and all along the way, actually, you really need to be aware of what's happening in the markets and the economy as you start planning your investment strategy so you can tweak your allocation between stocks and bonds or whatever other asset classes you're using every couple of years or so.
Exactly. And that's the next point that I think you need to revisit when you're putting together your retirement investment plan. You need to review the portfolio allocation in light of what's going on in the economy and the market environment. For example, one of the things we did on the program over the weekend, we did a segment called The Ugly, the Bad, and the Good. And that ugly was that 2007-2009 period where, you know, firms were going under, the bond market was getting clobbered, especially the mortgage market. We had stocks going down. It was the second major bear market in almost a decade. Then we went from sort of the bad period. The economy started to get better, but the unemployment remained stubbornly high up in the 10% level up until roughly the end of 2010. We had housing, which remained anemic because that was where the bubble formed until about 2012. Now we've gotten into the good period where things are beginning to stabilize. Are they great? No, but they're no longer bad and they're no longer ugly. Well, what I'm trying to say here is during that 5 or 6 year period, obviously when you're in the middle of the crisis in 2007 to 2009, what you needed to be doing from an investment perspective was obviously different in 2009 to 2012, which was basically the safety trade. And now I think we're moving more to the risk on trade as things begin to stabilize. But the same thing happens with an investment portfolio. You go through a business cycle. Obviously, the stocks or the type of assets you want to own when we're in a recession are going to be much, much different in a much different allocation than when the economy's booming. And so you need to revisit that. It's not kind of like, okay, here's my allocation. I can put it basically on the back shelf and not worry about it for the next 5 or 10 years. That's not the kind of markets that we operate in.
And Jim, I think when we're thinking about, you know, revisiting your investment planning, I think a lot of people sometimes forget about their 401k. You know, especially if you have an automatic contribution plan going, it's really easy to let years go by and never revisit that. And your 401k plan changes over time. Sometimes there's modifications to the plan. And so it's not a bad idea that you're here at that 10 years out from retirement mark. You know what? It's time to make a call to your HR department or talk to the person in your company who's responsible for your retirement plans, your pension funds, and all that sort of thing. Sit down with that person or get some feedback from them about, do you have any pension money that might be coming to you in retirement? How much? What are the distribution options? Maybe you had a deferred compensation plan. How much do you have set aside in that? How much might it grow by the time you retire? What are the distribution options for that? Also, just double checking on your employer match. Maybe when you first started with the company, they were young. They were only matching you up to maybe 3% of your contribution to your 401k. So you're only doing 3% of your salary into your 401k plan. Maybe now they're matching 5% or 7%. So double check your employer match to see what's going on with that, just to see if they're matching you a little bit more these days. Also, your investment options may change over time for your 401k plan. Some people that we talked to started out with maybe 4 or 5 mutual funds, 10 mutual fund options, and then all of a sudden their company added a self-directed brokerage option. So just double check on that, the 10-year mark. Just make sure you're fully informed about what's being offered to you in your retirement plans. And I think something that people often don't realize is a lot of employer-sponsored 401k plans and similar offer an option to do an in-service rollover at age 55 or age 59, which may mean that if you're not super thrilled with your 401k investment options, you can do an in-service rollover of part or all of your 401k into a self-directed IRA account with any broker that you want, any institution that you want, have full control over what you want to invest in with that. There's some cons to doing that, but it's something to think about. And I think the last thing people need to make sure of while they're on talking to this HR person, they might as well get some information on, does the company provide any healthcare benefits in retirement? How much do they provide? How much does it cost? So basically, while you're thinking about all of your retirement investment options, you're sitting down with the HR person, make sure you cover your retirement plans, your deferred compensation plans, and also, you know, healthcare benefits in retirement too.
Yeah, and speaking of that, it's probably a good time too, Kathleen, to recalculate the sources of your retirement income. I don't care if you're 10 years away or 5 years away. As you just mentioned there, you covered company pension, 401k programs. Also take a look at, as we have had several people from the Department of Social Security on the program, you can go online, check out your Social Security benefits so you know exactly what they're going to be if you take them early at age 62 or you wait till you're fully eligible for 100% of your benefits at age 66. So look at your Social Security benefits and then also take a look at really your investment income. Where's it going to come from? How are you invested? If what you're invested in now, what kind of income does it produce? And is it going to be enough to get you through your retirement years? But these are just some common things that you really need to focus on prior to 10 years out. And then, of course, these things become more critical when you're 5 years away from retirement.
Right, Jim, because when you're 5 years away from retirement, you know, the steps that you take don't really change a lot. You go through your budget again. You go through your investment allocation again. You go through recalculating your retirement income again. But now things start to get a little bit more specific and a little more real because you're only 5 years away at this point. So as far as getting more specific, here's what I'm talking about. When you're 10 years out, we told you to, you know, start thinking about if you're going to relocate in retirement. Well, now you're only 5 years out. Probably time to start narrowing down that possible move list to maybe 2 or 3 states or 2 or 3 cities so you can start getting a feel for what would the tax situation look like when you move there? What's the cost of living going to look like when you move there? How's that going to affect your budget? Also, again, here we are 5 years further down the road. Once again, you might have seen some health issues crop up with yourself or your family that might significantly affect your retirement spending. So again, you're 5 years further down the road. Some of these things become a lot more clear to you as you're at that point. So once again, reconfigure your budget based on the more information that you have now being 5 years further toward retirement.
And once again, to repeat what we talked about 10 years away, it's also time to even dial down the level of risk in your retirement investment portfolio even further. I mean, if you're well ahead of your retirement savings goal, let's say you wanted to have X amount of dollars when you retired, you've done well investing, you've exceeded that, which, you know, could change based on your budget inputs. This may not be as critical if you're ahead of your goals, but for most people, Kathleen, this is the time to really focus on low to moderate risk investments exclusively, and especially if investment income is going to be a key part of your retirement plan. And I think that's especially true today for boomers as opposed to, let's say, the boomers' parents who had defined benefit pension plans. Between Social Security and their defined benefit plan, they knew exactly what they were going to have. Where the boomers grew up, when corporations start shifting over to 401k programs, so investment income is going to play a larger part of meeting those retirement objectives. So you need to take a look at what source of income it's going to produce. And this doesn't have to all happen at once. We're not suggesting, okay, 5 years away from retirement, you walk in, you change your whole portfolio. It's something that you can do gradually. But at least, you know, I mentioned earlier about maybe switching more towards blue chip stocks. Well, maybe you refine that further and you might switch within the blue chip stocks to more higher dividend paying stocks, which are less volatile. If interest rates are still low at this point, maybe your bond investments at this time have short to intermediate maturities, let's say in the 3 to 5 year range, because you don't want to be going out 10, 20 years if interest rates are rising. But once again, recheck your investment portfolio, measure that in terms of how much of your retirement lifestyle is going to be dependent on your investment income, and looking at your portfolio, does it meet those investment income needs at retirement?
Speaking of income needs, Jim, I think it's a good idea. Again, we're 5 years out from retirement. Let's revisit those income numbers again. Let's go back to our HR person, see what we've got now in terms of benefits. What do they have set aside for us now in our deferred compensation plan? What sort of buyout programs are they offering now? What's my potential Social Security payout look out now? Has Social Security law changed since we visited this issue 5 years ago? So again, it's time to start revisiting those inputs for income again, because again, that might reconfigure or recalculate your savings goal again, might even change how long you need to keep working before you retire.
And I know that you have heard Kathleen and I hammer this point on the show about budgets and numbers. I know you're thinking, oh, there's too many numbers. It's not my favorite thing to do. But accurate budget numbers and income numbers are so important. The numbers determine, in many ways, the budget shortfall. Are you going to meet your living needs when you retire? Will they have to be made up by investments? If so, how much? Will it in turn determine, you know, should you be managing your retirement assets between now and your official retirement age? And at this point, you need to review your investment portfolio and gear it towards being able to produce a specific level of income by the time you retire.
And Jim, we should point out that this is talking about 2 to 3 years out from retirement. So at 5 years out from retirement, you dial down the risk level again. But once you're 2 to 3 years out and you've got that really specific budget number in mind, you've got a really good idea of the income sources, now is the time when you really start to hone in your investment portfolio on that specific budget shortfall that needs to be met by your investments, right?
Yeah, because what you don't want to do, and this is one of the, once again, why we talk about laddered bond programs versus bond funds, Kathleen, because if had you done these numbers, let's say in the year 2000 or 2001, and you said, okay, if I go 50% or 60% of my portfolio on bond funds, I'm going to get the exact income I need. Well, the trouble is, every single year, interest rates went down, and obviously the dividends on those bond funds were reduced every single year. So you thought you were in great shape the day you retired. Turns out that number was reduced, and was reduced every single year. So you really want to get specific. And that's why I like laddered bonds. I like blue chip dividend paying stocks, companies that have paid dividends for 30, 40, 50 years. Or heck, you take a company like Coca-Cola that paid dividends throughout the Great Depression, World War II, and have been paying dividends consistently ever since then. But you want something that's specific, because that's what you're going to need. You don't want to end up in your third year of retirement and saying, gee, I thought I was going to get X amount of dollars from my investments. It turns out I don't.
Right, Jim. So that when you're 2 to 3 years out from retirement, you're looking at that specific budget shortfall number, looking at your investments and starting to rotate your investments into things that'll produce the level of income you need in 2 to 3 years when you retire. So maybe there's a certain portion of your allocation when you're 2 to 3 years out from retirement, you start to move towards dividend paying companies. And maybe those dividend payouts don't meet your income need right now, or they won't meet your income need in retirement at their current rates. But maybe they have dividend growth rates that mean that they may meet or may come closer to meeting your income needs while you're in retirement. So again, when you're 2 to 3 years out, you start to look at some really specific income goals for your portfolio and gearing your investments in the portfolio to meet that specific income target. I was thinking too, Jim, when you're 2 to 3 years out from retirement, you've pretty much usually by that time decided a specific state you're going to live in or whether or not you're going to downsize or upscale your lifestyle in retirement. So if you're thinking about making a move, selling a home or buying a home, for example, when you're 2 to 3 years out from retirement, it's probably a good idea to start meeting with your local realtor and checking in to see what are the going rates for homes in our area. How long might it take our home to sell? Should we put the home on the market now or when we're a year away from retirement or 6 months away from retirement? Kind of just getting a time frame for that turnover of your home if you're looking to sell it in retirement and move. And same thing goes for the other end of the deal too. If you're thinking about selling one home and moving into another one, time to reach out to the realtor in that new area too and say, what are the home prices in the area? How long does it take to do a buy? How stiff is the competition for a home? And just really start doing some of that groundwork to prep for any sort of purchase or sale of a home that you might have in your budget. Because again, whether you're renting or earning rental income on these properties as you're approaching retirement, it's going to make a big difference on your overall spend number once you've finally retired.
You bring up a key point because I just want to go back to something we covered on the program over the weekend. And that was nobody, Kathleen, back in 2007, not even the chairman of the Federal Reserve, ever imagined that we'd see housing prices fall 30 to 40%. I mean, housing prices for most of the years or decades following World War II, it was a steady progression up. And that's why if you have a lot of equity in your home and that equity is going to be need to turn into investment income, let's say you're counting on selling your house, extracting that equity, downsizing, and that's going to become part of your portfolio, you might want to really talk to your realtor. How's the market right now? What are happening to prices in homes in my area? Because imagine if all of a sudden you were counting on the equity in your home and you retired in the year 2008 when the housing market was collapsing and really remained weak until roughly the summer of 2012 when really we began to see for the first time housing prices, according to the Case-Shiller Index, start to rise across the country. So really looking at that and trying to get some specific payout numbers from your pension, your Social Security, and really looking at your investments in terms of, all right, what can I expect to get from this? One of the reasons I like and often recommend blue chip stocks, especially companies that have been paying dividends for 2 or 3 decades, consistently pay dividends. You know they have a dividend track record. You know approximately what that dividend goes up each year. You have some degree of predictability of what you're going to have from dividends. And likewise, when you do a laddered bond portfolio, really what we're trying to say here is start getting specific because you don't want to sit there and retire and then all of a sudden the income you thought you were going to have isn't there.
Jim, I think it's really important when you say to get specific. I think especially when you're only 2 to 3 years out away from retirement, I think it's time to really start looking at making not just one, not just two, but 3 budgets if you're married. And why in the world would I say 3 budgets? I'm going to say 3 budgets and 3 income calculations based on when both of you are alive, when spouse A passes away, and when spouse B passes away. Because that may make a determination as you start getting these pension paperwork packages from your company as you approach retirement. Usually they'll ask you to select some kind of a survivor benefit option. If you've done those 3 calculations, both of you together, spouse A passing away first, spouse B passing away first, you'll be able to make a really smart decision as far as survivorship benefit options, whether it's 50% or 75% or 100%. So it's pretty important that you start, you know, again, crunching the budget numbers. In this case, doing the 3 different budgets. And Jim, I think what's really important is when you reach this point where you're 2 to 3 years out from retirement, if you're doing your numbers right, doing your homework right, you should be able to do a pretty good pinpointing of a very specific target retirement date, you know, such as I'm going to be able to retire in roughly June of 2018 or whatever it is. Once you're that close to retirement, you should be able to pretty much target a month and a year when you should be able to retire and be able to make ends meet.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked through a number of clients through a lot of these scenarios, 10 years, 5 years out. We're working with a client right now who basically retired 5 years ago, but he's a doctor. He was working part-time because he wanted to do that. He brought in extra money, but we're now reworking his retirement plan. He's going to turn age 70 and a half this year, which means, number one, the amount of assets that we rolled over from his pension to his IRA, he's been allowing those to accumulate. He didn't need the income, but now he's going to be forced to take a mandatory distribution. But he's also thinking, you know what, I'm tired. He was working a couple days a week. He wants to get as much travel as he can over the next 5 years. He's still in good health. So we're reworking his retirement plan, even though he retired 5 years ago, where the plan was allow the IRA to continue to accumulate in between personal investments and part-time work. That would take care of him being actually semi-retired. Now, at age 70 and a half, he's going full-time into retirement. So once again, we're reworking his plan.
I think the takeaway I'm getting from this discussion, Jim, is that your retirement plan is always going to need to be tweaked a little bit. Maybe your budget needs to be taken a look at again. Maybe you need to make some sacrifices. Maybe you need to change your investment approach based on what's happening in the markets and the economy. Maybe the amount you're saving for retirement needs to change either up or down. Maybe your time horizon to retirement may need to come forward or back a couple of years. And I'm sure our listeners noted that once again, that evil B word, the budget, seems to play a pretty key part in this whole retirement planning scenario.
Well, I'm thinking about it. You know, once again, the retirement budget may include supporting other family members. It's something that, Kathleen, you and I have seen crop up over the years. Sometimes this is due to health issues, sometimes to life circumstances, helping out children. Children get divorced, they get laid off. We're dealing with a tough situation now where one of our clients moved into a retirement home and all of a sudden her son's business didn't work out and now she's supporting a son. And it's a very difficult strain on the budget in terms of meeting not only her own needs, because living in a retirement home isn't cheap, and plus also her travel needs. She likes to travel. And now all of a sudden supporting a child. Those are, Kathleen, what I call the unexpected contingencies that crop up that you weren't expecting. So that's why I think having a spare cushion and, you know, sort of having sort of emergency backup plan if something comes up. And it's unfortunate, but you know, sometimes we do end up providing financial support for family members that the need is beyond your ability to pay. We've had clients who have actually drained their retirement assets to support family members and then not be able to support themselves. So you don't want to find yourself in that situation and really plan for contingencies, because we know life is always full of surprises and they happen when you least expect them.
Well, Jim, as you were mentioning, we've had several clients who've planned so well that their retirement plans can include several major vacations every year. And as our listeners may be aware, we ran some best of lifetime income programs over the past couple of weeks to accommodate my vacation. I just got back from a trip to Idaho to see family, spent some time camping with my little brother's family on the South Fork of the Clearwater, which was probably a much cheaper vacation than the ones that you and Christopher Elliott from Nat Geo's Traveler magazine are going to talk about next.
Well, yeah, unfortunately, you start going overseas, especially international travel, which a lot of people like to do, Kathleen, that gets expensive. Well, coming up next, Christopher Elliott has some travel cost tips for us. Cost is probably one of the main areas of his expertise, as noted in his new book that will be out next March, How to Be the World's Smartest Traveler, Save Time, Money, and Hassle. And by the way, he has made these chapters available free. So if you have a question on a particular matter relating to travel, he's got an outline in his book that we'll talk about. But if you email him, he will actually email you back the chapter of the book that covers this area. So if travel makes up part of your retirement plans or even current plans, stay tuned. Coming up next, Christopher Elliott from National Geographic, right after this. Joining me on the program today is Chris Elliott. He is from National Geographic and author of the upcoming book, How to Be the World's Smartest Traveler and Save Time, Money, and Hassle. Chris, one of the first things that come to mind when I think about travel is travel advice. There's travel agents. You can go online. Let's talk about if you're planning a trip, let's say something serious, going to Europe, maybe you're going to Asia. How do you find reliable travel advice?
That's a great question. Actually, I spend the entire first chapter of my book on trying to answer that because, you know, now it used to be that you just go to your travel agent and get some advice and then book a trip based on that. But now, of course, you have a lot of other places that you can go. You can go to a guidebook. You can go to a website. You can go to an online bulletin board or a blog. And they have varying levels. You know, user-generated reviews is a good example. TripAdvisor. You can't always be entirely sure of who is writing these reviews and how reliable they are. And so one of the things I do is try to help people sort it out. And the bottom line advice that I give is that you should always go to someone who you know and who knows you and maybe who has been to the destination that you're thinking of going to, and they're probably going to be in the best position to give you advice. And from that point on, it goes down to, you know, you want to maybe get advice from a real person, someone who's an expert. And at the very bottom, you know, you have the TripAdvisors and Yelps of the world where you don't know who's writing your review. It could be anyone. And you don't know what their past experience is. You don't know what they like or dislike. So you're not even sure if what they're saying is relevant to you.
Yeah, because I know there's substantial savings by trying to do it yourself and doing it online. But, you know, let's say you're going to a new country. You've never been there before. How do you know you're booking a motel in the right neighborhood or it'll have the accommodations that you expect? So I guess that's where talking to somebody that's actually been there is helpful.
Absolutely. And again, you know, there's a process I refer to it as triangulation because you're kind of using separate data points and then figuring out what the best decision is going to be for you. So even if you have a review on TripAdvisor that you're not really sure about, you can use it as a data point and then use several other data points to figure out what the best advice is. So just as an example, that motel in a country you've never been to, if you see one or two really bad reviews on Yelp, for example, and your travel agent tells you that that's a neighborhood to avoid, and your best friend tells you, you know, stay out of there, then you can be reasonably assured that you probably don't want to be booking a hotel room there.
So finding, let's say, a good person, somebody that you know and somebody that's actually been there, I think would be most helpful. Are you going to have to pay a lot for that? I mean, let's take a local travel agent that has an office in town where you can actually walk in the office, look at the person and talk to them. Would you advise that?
Yeah. Well, first of all, agents are not, there's a kind of a commonly held belief that agents are more expensive than booking online. That is not always true. Sometimes travel agents actually have access to deals that are better than the ones you can find online. But what an agent gives you is that personal touch. It's someone who can hold your hand, can make sure that, you know, all the payments are made, and they can help you with paperwork to make sure your passport is in order and you have all the right visas. So that can be very, very useful. So I definitely would recommend the services of a travel agent. And this is especially true if you have a problem or misgivings with booking online. You're not entirely comfortable with that. I would definitely consider using a travel agent. But that's the other thing. And later on in the book, I get into this. And just as a reminder, this is called How to Be the World's Smartest Traveler. And it's not out yet, but you can pre-order it. But later on in the book, I talk about how you can actually go online and book a trip, but that, you know, if you have a special need or if you need a special expertise, a travel agent can be a really great way to go.
And they can help you, let's say, book your trip for everything from hotel accommodations and also to travel. Let's talk about papers, because depending on what part of the world that you're going to, I mean, you got to have a passport once you leave the country. What about things like visas, birth certificates, IDs, things like that? You know, it's like if I'm buying something here locally in a store and I give them a credit card, they want to see some kind of personal ID. So, you know, you usually show them your driver's license. What kind of paperwork should you have in order if you are going overseas?
Well, for most of the countries that you would visit, you don't need a visa and you just need a passport. And in some cases, you don't even need a passport. You need a passport card. But the best place to find all that information is on the State Department website. That's state.gov. And they have a special travel-related website. I believe the URL is travel.state.gov. So that's the most authoritative. And then also you can check the embassy of the country that you're visiting. They all have websites for their Washington embassies, and in some cases also the consulates have websites. So that would be my recommendation, is to find it there. But the really important thing is to remember that the paperwork is your responsibility. It's not your travel agent's responsibility. It's not the airline's responsibility. It is yours. So you got to make sure that you have all of the right visas and passports and stamps and whatever else permits that you may need. So make sure that, you know, if you're planning a trip somewhere where maybe many Americans don't go, that you have done all of the due diligence that you need.
Let's talk about, let's say, cash or spendable money when you're overseas, because you're going to be going out to restaurants, you may be going to shops, you may be going to museums, exhibits. I mean, how do you know what the right balance is between, let's say, carrying cash, a credit card, traveler's checks? How do you balance all of that?
Sometimes with great difficulty, actually. What I always recommend, and what I have in this book too, is that you want to get a combination. You want to have at least two credit cards. You want to have, and the reason why is, if for some reason you forget to tell your credit card company that you're traveling overseas, it may cancel one of your cards, but it probably won't cancel two of them. And I don't know if you've ever been somewhere where your card has suddenly been canceled because of your bank's fraud detection algorithm, but it can really put you in a very vulnerable position because you have no access to money anymore. But then the other thing you can do is you can go to your bank and buy currency. So if you're going to Europe, you would go to your bank and say, I need to buy 200 euros. You can use that then to pay off, you know, the cab when you're traveling to your hotel or something like that. And that's actually really, you know, most people don't do that. They wait until they get to the train station or the airport, and then they have to go to one of these really expensive currency exchange kiosks where they have a very uncompetitive exchange rate, and sometimes they even charge a commission. So you want to try to avoid that if possible. But basically, you know, you want to have multiple payment options at your disposal as opposed to just one or two.
And don't credit cards, if you're using your credit card overseas, isn't there an extra charge for currency exchange?
Yes, there are all sorts of charges that you have to be aware of. The one that people get hit with the most is the fees for going to an ATM. They may not be aware of that, but they could be paying almost as much to access their money as they are for getting to actually get the money for themselves. But there's actually two other major pitfalls. One of them is the currency exchange fee. And that kicks in even if you're not exchanging dollars. So let's say that you're in another country where they're using dollars, you're actually paying in dollars. The credit card company doesn't care. They're going to charge you 2-3% because you're using the credit card over, across the border. The other one is called dynamic currency conversion. And that kicks in when you're, say, you're at a hotel, they say, oh, you're an American. Would you like to be billed in dollars? And you think to yourself, wow, what a convenience. What they won't tell you is that the exchange rate they're giving you is not that competitive, and that the hotel is making money off of converting your dollars, your charge into dollars for your convenience. And the other thing to remember, too, is that you probably are going to get charged by your credit card again just because you're making a purchase overseas for a foreign exchange fee. There are some cards that don't have foreign exchange fees. Capital One is a really good example of that.
I want to talk about something that we see, and especially with seniors that are traveling where they have medication that they need. How do you stay healthy and safe when you're overseas? In other words, I guess, Chris, what could go wrong?
Everything can go wrong. The funny thing is that when I was writing this, I started looking through all the notes that I had kept over the last 20 years of advocating for consumers, and I just saw all sorts of different tragedies unfolding that were entirely preventable. The medical ones are actually, in some cases, the saddest ones because, you know, you really, on the one hand, you can't control if you have a heart attack overseas, but you can control things like medication and the basic preventive medicine, things like getting your shots, making sure that you have the right medication in case you get malaria, that kind of thing. You would actually probably be surprised at the types of things that cause problems. You know, dog bites are a very common issue overseas. You know, we have dogs and cats that are pets here, but overseas, a lot of times dogs, cats are free roaming, and visitors will try to pet them and then get bitten, and they'll have to go in for a rabies shot. So that's a really big issue. And diarrhea, too, is actually that's the leading medical issue. And that's also something that's very preventable. You know, you can avoid drinking untreated water, and you can carry medication with you that can prevent that. So if you have a trip somewhere that you're taking and it's a little bit exotic, you know, somewhere where maybe they don't have a first world or second world medical standards and facilities, you may want to go see a travel medicine specialist before you go to make sure that you have all your shots. In some cases, actually, shots are required. So go to the CDC website to make sure that you have all the required shots. But then also make sure that you have like a little first aid kit that you take with you just in case something does go wrong.
We're used to buying some kind of insurance. Travel insurance, do you need it, and what does it cover?
There's two basic kinds of travel insurance. There's the garden variety travel insurance that will cover you for specific reasons. And then there's also the cancel for any reason that'll cover you for up to 80% if for any reason if you want to cancel. The thing to know about travel insurance is that it's such a complicated and complex product that you really have to get into the weeds almost immediately when you're shopping for these things. Make sure that the condition that you may want to make a claim for is covered. You know, one of the most common things is a pre-existing medical condition. And people assume that because they have travel insurance that they're going to be covered. And they, you know, maybe have arthritis that acts up or something like that. And the doctor says you can't travel. And guess what? You're not covered. So you have to make sure that you're actually doing all of the research from the get-go. And that means reading the fine print and consulting with multiple sources, too. You don't want to just go to one place, like, say, your travel agent, and they hand you an insurance policy. Or worse yet, this is a particular issue with cruise ships, where a cruise line will say, hey, you want to get our insurance, you'll be protected. Well, what they don't tell you is that there are all sorts of exclusions. So make sure that you know what's in the policy and that you've shopped around and you know what the exclusions are and what is covered, so that if you do have to make a claim, you'll know, yes, this is covered.
When you travel overseas, especially with airlines today, where they're charging you for luggage, what about the right kind of luggage, the right amount of clothing to take? Is there any kind of rules or guidelines? Because I know a lot of people get to the airport, they have these huge suitcases, and all of a sudden they find out they're paying all these extra fees to fly.
Well, I don't know if there's a guideline that everyone can agree on that. Some people just like to take everything with them. And what you need to know is that when you're flying, and if you don't have a ticket in business class or first class, you're going to be paying for every bag that you check. It can really add up after a while. Plus, their overweight luggage fees. If you're flying within Europe, it's even more restrictive. In some cases, they will even charge you for the bag that you carry on the plane. And it sounds absolutely absurd, but it's true. So the advice that I would give is to always pack light. And if you think that you might incur extra luggage fees, either buy what you need at the destination or have your luggage shipped. That actually may, in some cases, be less expensive than having the airline check it and transport it with you. But the packing advice that I give in this book actually applies not just to airlines, but also to cars. You know, most people in the United States, when they travel, they drive there. In fact, 9 out of 10 miles traveled is in a car, not on a plane for most Americans. So when you talk about packing right, most people take more luggage than they need. They pack more clothes, and they don't pack enough to eat. So what happens is that you have all this stuff in the back of your car and not enough food, and you end up having to stop frequently. And in some cases, you're eating the food that you don't want to be eating because you just didn't pack right. So I always say half the clothes and twice the food that you normally would, and you'll be good to go.
Let's talk about when you get to your location. Let's say you're taking a trip to Europe, and of course, once you get into your hotel, you unpack your bags and everything. Let's talk about renting a car and traveling when you're overseas, because not only do you need to get transportation, whether you're taking a cab or you're renting a car, but also you're going to need insurance on that car. What are some of the important things one should consider?
Yeah, well, every country is a little slightly different. There's no country quite like the United States when it comes to transportation. You know, we're We're a driving country, but if you go overseas, if you go to Europe, for example, they get around using a lot of mass transit, and the rail systems are really excellent. There's kind of a point where it really is not worth taking the train. If you have a large family, you may actually want to rent a car. I like going to a company like Auto Europe because they're experts on renting cars in Europe, and you have the same peace of mind that you would get booking a rental car in the United States. But again, this is where doing a lot of research before you leave can really pay off. I mean, if you're going to a fairly small country where the mass transit infrastructure is great, or if you're staying in a city, it may just be worth it to fly into the airport, take the train into town, and then use mass transit or even walk. It's just really difficult to give advice like that because every destination is slightly different. But again, a little bit of research can pay off for you.
What about, I guess, when you're trying to look at overall cost? You've got the cost of airline travel getting to where you want to get. You have hotel accommodations. Let's talk about language and guides. Let's say you've never been to Europe before. Let's say you're going to Italy. You don't speak Italian. What about guides in the area, hiring a guide or booking a guide through your travel agent? And also, let's say a language translator. Do you advise those?
Yes, actually, the advice I would give in a situation like that is to consider a tour. You know, a travel agent or a tour operator can offer a package tour, which is all of the components of a vacation, including sometimes meals and a guide, all wrapped into one. And also, you know, transportation is frequently included, like buses, motor coach to and from a hotel or your attraction. So I would probably do that before I hired a translator. There are any number of good translation apps, but again, they're very clunky. And if you really want to get around like a local, sometimes the best way of doing that is to hire a local person to help you around. And that's especially true if it's far afield in a place that most Americans don't go. But really, though, if you're thinking of going to a place like that, somewhere really exotic, I probably would consider a package tour before doing it yourself.
Would you advise that, Chris, if let's say somebody is going overseas for the first time, they're taking a trip, let's say they're going to go see three or four countries in Europe, would you advise a tour? Because with a tour, most of the time, they take care of the hotels, the meals, they know where to go, they handle the language difficulties and other issues that you have to deal with.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've been on some tours in Europe, even where in places where I spoke the language, and I just found that the guides knew much more than I ever would and showed us places, got us into museums that we would never have been able to get into. And it was structured in such a way where we would go from one attraction to a meal and then to another attraction. And we got to see so much more than if it was just us, you know, going alone and having to buy tickets ourselves. And then where we were going to lunch, all that was taken care of. So there's definitely some conveniences to that. And I would recommend a tour. If you want to see three or four countries in Europe, I would definitely go for a tour. You might even want to go for something like a cruise tour where you're going on one of those river boats going down the Danube or the Rhine River and stopping along the way and just you know, visiting the little villages and the castles, that kind of thing. That's just an absolute blast, and I highly recommend something like that.
What about cruise ships? I have a lot of clients that take cruises, and they love it because, you know, you get on board the ship, you unpack your bags once, and, you know, you can see Europe, you can see Italy, Greece, and many spots without having to always constantly be repacking your bags.
Well, cruise ships can be a really great option for travelers. I mean, in the past, there were the people who cruised, and then there were the people who would never imagine cruising. And there's been actually a lot of new people who have come to cruising, and there's a lot more cruise options now than there have ever been. You can go on a theme cruise, you can go to around the world cruises. There's any number of things that you can do. What I would say, though, is you've got to really be careful. The cruise can be a really good deal. It is something that is sold to you as an all-inclusive product, so the meals are included. But what cruise lines have done is taken a page from the airlines. They have actually started upselling you extras. So you're sitting at the table having a really nice dinner, and the server comes by and asks if you want a premium meal or if you want a bottle of wine and not an inexpensive one too. So there are a lot of opportunities on a cruise ship to really run up a bill. And what I recommend in this book is if you're traveling with kids, make sure that that little card that they give you, the key card when you board the ship, is not activated for your kids so that they can't go to the arcade and run up like a $500 bill. And that actually happened to someone that I knew. Their teenager had like a $500 bill from playing arcade games. It was pretty bad. So, but the other thing is keep a real close eye on your expenses. The other thing that can really run up your bill is a shore excursion. Shore excursions are, as you know, day trips when a ship is in port that will take you maybe snorkeling or hiking or on a bus tour. And those can be very, very expensive. And they can, you know, if you add the whole family, they can cost almost as much as the cruise fare just for a day. So be real careful. And my advice is to shop around. Sometimes you can get the same type of shore excursion just by going ashore and talking to someone there and getting the same thing. Those shore excursions can typically cost twice as much because the cruise line is building its cost into that. So they're on the take a little bit. And then there's also commissions that have to get paid. So anyway, that would be one way of saving money. But definitely watch your bottom line when you're on a cruise, because you can really run up a big bill.
Yeah, because I've always assumed that when you get on a cruise ship, you get one all-inclusive cost, which includes all your meals, your accommodations, and the only thing you pay for is if you stop into port. But what you're telling me, that's not necessarily the case.
No, unfortunately not.
If you were advising somebody that was traveling for the first time, let's just take a couple. They finally retired. They really want to take the big trip, you know, maybe 2 weeks to Europe or something that they didn't or weren't able to do during their working career. If you were traveling for the first time overseas, would you recommend a tour? In other words, go to an agent, find out the different package tours that they have and do that versus trying to do it all yourself?
Oh, if it's your first time? Absolutely. Yeah, I would. No question about it. You would be crazy to try doing it all alone. I mean, you probably could, but after all of the headaches of planning and navigating a system that might be unfamiliar to you, you could save a ton of money and also a ton of time and just go to a tour operator. But what I would say is definitely shop around. Don't just go to the first tour operator that your agent recommends. And you can also go online and look up these various tour operators. One really good source actually is the U.S. Tour Operators Association. It's ustoa.org is the website. And they actually have, they're insured. They have very high standards. So if you're booking a tour through a tour operator that is a USTOA member, and you have some peace of mind too.
Chris, can you tell us a little bit about your book, what you cover in this book, and when it'll be available for our listeners?
Oh, sure, yeah. If you go to my site, which is elliott.org, it's ELLIOTT.org, you can actually, there's a little link that you can click on and you can pre-order the book. It's called How to Be the World's Smartest Traveler. The book itself is a collection of past columns from people who have run into problems and turned to me for help. What I do actually is I help people solve their travel problems. So you'll see some real solutions to real problems. But beyond that, it's kind of a worst case manual for travel. So anything that can possibly go wrong, I've got it in this book, and I help people figure out how to get out of trouble if they're in trouble and how to avoid trouble, more importantly. So the tagline is how to save time, money, and hassle, and I do all of the above.
And this book will be available when?
It's not going to be out until March of next year, but you can pre-order it. And if you, one thing I will say for your listeners, if you're in a situation where you say, oh, gee, you know, I'm going to rent a car or I'd like to take a cruise and I really want the advice that's in this book, send me an email. I'll give you my email address. It's elliottc@gmail.com. So it's ELLIOTTC@gmail.com. And I'll actually send you a draft of the chapter. So I'm happy to share that with you if it's helpful. And I think it will be, actually.
And that email again?
Yeah, it's ElliottC, ELLIOTTC, @gmail.com.
All right. We've been speaking with Christopher Elliott, whose new book, How to Be the World's Smartest Traveler and Save Time, Money, and Hassle, will be out next year. But as you just heard Chris say, if you do have some particular issues you would like to discuss or get information, Chris has been kind enough. He could send you the chapter that covers that issue. Chris, I want to thank you for joining us on Lifetime Income.
Thank you.
Well, that concludes my interview with Christopher Elliott. Once again, his book will be coming out next March, but as you heard Chris say during that interview, if you have a particular issue you're concerned about regarding travel, shoot him an email and he'll send you the chapter of his book free that will discuss or help you resolve the issues that you face. I thought it was very generous of him. Anyway, on behalf of Kathleen Harris and myself, Jim Poplava, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. I thought it was time to cover the issue of travel because so many of you, when you get into retirement, spend a lot of the, you know, those extra bucket list items are usually regarding travel. And here's a guy that works for National Geographic, knows a lot about the subject matter, so I thought it was time to cover it. Anyway, on behalf of both Kathleen and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.